Laura Ling and Yuna Lee arrived home safely yesterday.
Yay!
We were shocked, but we knew instantly in our hearts that the nightmare of our lives was finally coming to an end.
But will the nightmare for the citizens of North Korea ever end? We talked to two psychiatrists on post-traumatic stress disorder on the show today, but maybe the people who need it most are still imprisoned in the Hermit Kingdom. Just a thought on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Now, there's a good question. Good morning. Who are the hostages? Maybe it's the people of North Korea. It's Thursday, August 6th. I'm John Hockenberry, joined this morning by Amy Holmes, in with us all week.
Good morning, Amy. On the show today, former President Bill Clinton, fix-it man, will rate his performance in North Korea, and the GOP isn't backing Sonia Sotomayor in her Senate vote today. How will that play at the polls? And ahead of Afghanistan's presidential elections, we'll take a closer look at the incumbent, Mr. Karzai. But first, we have Dr. Yael Danieli on the phone with us, a clinical psychologist and trauma specialist. So, doctor, who needs the psychology more, Laura Ling and Yuna Lee, or the people of North Korea?
Well, the people of North Korea need a whole lot more than a psychologist. But that the psychological understanding would be part of what they need when they have the opportunity.
I agree. I hope they get it. Dr. Danieli, please stay with us. We'll continue the conversation with you. But first, the headlines.
And in the headlines, a new deadline from the president.
I promise you, we will pass reform by the end of this year because the American people need it. The American people need some relief.
The president made the declaration in Indiana yesterday that he needs health care reform by the end of the year. He meets with members of the Senate Finance Committee from both parties today to talk health care. By the way, you can go to our website, thetakeaway.org, to check out our primer on health care reform 101. Todd Zwillick helps to break down all the plans floating through Congress. And this hour, we get a closer look at the job market. How many people applied for unemployment benefits last week? We'll find out. Amy?
If the Senate votes to triple the size of the cash for clunkers piggy bank today, some of those people on the unemployment line could get a break. Automakers are hinting that they'll boost production and bring back some laid-off workers if the extra $2 billion in cash comes through. Overseas, Afghan officials say at least 21 people on their way to a wedding were killed by a roadside bomb in the country's south. The attack happened as the new NATO head was making his first trip to southern Afghanistan.
A Charles Manson follower convicted of trying to assassinate President Gerald Ford is being released from a Texas prison later this month. Lynette Squeaky Fromm was 26 when she aimed a gun at Ford in 1975. Secret Service agents wrestled it away. Markets mostly flat yesterday, but the NASDAQ closed down about 1%. The Dow opens next hour at 9281. The S&P starts trading at 10.03, and the NASDAQ begins at 1993. We're having a bit of a controversy here at The Takeaway. Paula Abdul is leaving American Idol. Is she famous for being famous, or is she famous for being formerly famous? Is she famous for being a wacko? Anyway, are you sorry to see her go? And who else would you like to say goodbye to who's, let's just face it, famous for basically being famous? Ryan Seacrest is, of course, my candidate. 877-8-MY-TAKE or send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Saying goodbye to the famously famous or famously not quite so famous.
And you know who mercifully went away? Cato Kaelin.
Yeah.
We don't hear about him anymore.
Yeah. Our small national nightmare has been over for a while now.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here. So, Amy, you know, I may be out on a limb here, okay? But historically speaking, I think it's fair to say that this scenario until yesterday might not have inspired total confidence or hope in the hearts of, say, two young single women.
We were told that we were going to a meeting. We were taken to a location, and when we walked in through the doors, we saw standing before us President Bill Clinton.
Okay, they're not both single, all right. But for Laura Ling, journalist, and Yuna Lee, seeing Bill Clinton there in that room by surprise marked the beginning of the hope that their 12-year sentence in North Korea might be ending. Beginning of hope for two terrified journalists. We're going to talk about what the rehabilitation psychologically means for them in a moment. But it's also the end of a political rehabilitation for Bill Clinton, who suffered mightily during the campaign, but suddenly looks like a hero this morning. Peter Baker, reporter for our partners, The New York Times, joins us now. Bill Clinton, a hero today. This is the end of a very long sort of political retooling for Bill Clinton. He's looking pretty good this morning, Peter.
Well, that's right. I think, you know, here he is almost 9 years after his presidency, and he's showing that he still has a place to on the world stage, even in the era of Obama.
Now, it seems to me, and I'm just, you know, looking behind the scenes here, that some of this is conditional on him not actually grabbing the microphone and starting to talk. He didn't speak yesterday. He hasn't made any official comment on what happened. Seems like he's not likely to do so. Do you think that Bill Clinton can actually maintain that discipline?
Well, you know, what his office told us yesterday is that he wanted this to be the day for the families. He did not speak, as you say, at the event. You know, on the other hand, he does have an event scheduled today, I believe, in Harlem to announce, I think, an AIDS program. And it wouldn't surprise me if that became an opportunity for him to say a few words about the trip. But, you know, look, he's been doing this for a long time. He has a real sense of moment. He has a real sense of how to play an event like this, when it's right to talk and when it's not.
Peter Baker, this is Amy Holmes here. So you can't help, at least I can't help, but wonder about the psychodrama between Secretary Clinton and President Clinton. He certainly has upstaged her this week. Do you think that she, you know, is in any way irritated by this, or that they are building the Clinton brand? They are burnishing the Clinton name.
Well, you know, it's a good question. Everybody would like to know the answer, wouldn't they? I think certainly the timing of him landing in Pyongyang at the same time she's landing in Nairobi for the beginning of an 11-day trip through Africa put her way on the back burner. And, you know, certainly in the short term, he has upstaged her, you know, intentionally or not.
I loved, Peter, that it was Al Gore who noted Obama's role in this and Secretary Clinton's role in this when he gave his remarks yesterday.
Well, there's a whole, you know, series of interplays and odd relationships here that are at play. I mean, here, you know, Bill Clinton and Al Gore haven't been all that close in the last 8, 9, 10 years either, you know, and obviously there was a rivalry last year between the Clintons and President Obama. So
But I read it in the Times. Adam Nagorny had that piece yesterday. They hugged for 5 minutes or something, 5 seconds, 5 seconds. He timed the hug.
It was quite a while. Somebody, a friend of mine, compared it to Alan Tipper's awkward kiss at the convention in 2000.
Interesting. Well, before we go, any sort of remarks on the sort of powerful pair of Bill Clinton and John Podesta, former chief of staff for Bill Clinton and now head of a think tank in Washington, emerging from that plane? There's the Clinton brand that Amy was talking about, but there's also Clinton Inc. here. Is Podesta part of that?
Yeah, definitely part of that. Well, Podesta is the link at the moment between the Clinton and Obama world. He was President Clinton's last chief of staff. Chief of staff, by the way, when President Clinton wanted to go to North Korea in the dwindling days of his presidency and couldn't make it work. Today, he is the head of a think tank, but he's also an informal advisor to President Obama. He was the head of his transition team, and he has done an awful lot to staff this administration with people from his think tank over the last number of months. So he is a real bridge, I think, between these two.
Lots of bridges and beyond the 21st century, that's for sure. Peter
that's
Baker,
right.
White House correspondent for The New York Times. Lots to think about there. Thanks so much.
Hey, thanks very much. Have a good evening.
Sure.
So political recovery for Bill Clinton seems to be underway, but recovery and rehabilitation might be a little bit more complicated for Una Lee and Laura Ling. Here's what Laura told reporters.
The past 140 days have been the most difficult, heart-wrenching time of our lives.
Joining us to discuss the process of recovery is Dr. Yael Danieli, a clinical psychologist and trauma specialist who has a private practice here in New York City. We're also joined by Anthony Feinstein, professor of psychiatry at the University of Toronto and author of Journalists Under Fire, The Psychological Hazards of Covering War. Dr. Danieli, I want to start with you. You've written and counseled extensively on the emotional aftermath of hostages and political prisoners. Can you help us understand what Laura and Una might be feeling right now as they adjust to this new freedom?
Of course. Right now, they're probably not sure whether they're sleeping or awake. whether they are in a nightmare or in a happy dream. The sounds, the smells, the whether they're in their own beds or in the United States or in North Korea.
So you would say they probably are feeling just total disorientation.
Yes, disorientation and somewhat of a culture shock on some level.
Do victims of these types of circumstances of, you know, being held prisoner or hostage, do they suffer a sense of emotional isolation that no one can really understand what they went through?
They tend to. They depends to a large degree also if they were imprisoned together or separately. My impression is that they must have been together because speaking, she used the word we. My impression is that they were together, which is helpful.
Interesting. Dr. Feinstein, I want to bring you into this. You work with journalists who cover war. Do journalists suffer in particular ways? Do they often feel obligated, for example, to go public with their story before they're ready because of their profession as storytellers?
I think there are going to be many pressures and stresses on the journalists here. Certainly that's one that you've highlighted, but that's not an invariable situation. I also think that much will depend on how the journalists were treated while in captivity. It's also been my experience with journalists that the range of stress that they're subjected to while held captive can vary. The journalists who can be treated fairly and quite well while in captivity, they can be fed, they don't necessarily have to be beaten or tortured. And then I've come across situations where journalists have been treated abysmally while in captivity, threatened with execution, mock execution, etc. So I think a lot can depend on the circumstances of the captivity.
Well, Dr. Feinstein, it seems to me that in this particular case, there are a couple of differences between a lot of the hostages that we've covered and that you've focused on in your research. I mean, they wanted to see the inside of North Korea. As traumatic as this must have been for them, they also had a window, an absolutely fascinating window on a society that almost no journalist gets to see. And in telling that story, it seems to me they have a leg up on the aftermath that someone who is maybe chained to a bed in Lebanon doesn't have.
Correct. I think, I'm not familiar with the exact circumstances of their captivity, but you raise a good point. And it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out in future as they recover from this ordeal, because that may in fact turn out to be a positive factor when they look back on this awful captivity for themselves.
Dr. Danielli, how do they go back to normal? Is that possible after this kind of experience?
The phrase going back to normal always worries me because you don't go back. There is the cultural demand to go back to normal, but we just don't do that. And if there is the pressure to do that, it stands in the way of recovery. But as journalists, actually, there are people with a mission and people who are used to covering stories, which means to put experiences into words. And the articulation of traumatic experiences is helpful in itself in the struggle to heal. So as journalists, they do have a leg up. But as people who are public victims, they will have special challenges in the sense that their natural recovery will very well be interfered with.
I'm sure I speak for all of us when I say that we're pulling for these two ladies. Thank you for joining us. That was Dr. Yael Danielli and Dr. Anthony Feinstein, both psychiatrists who study this issue closely.
Well, there's a tension there. I mean, I agree with her that if you're a journalist, it's actually helpful because you're...
To be a storyteller.
Well, you can go through it. You can tell the narrative of your captivity. I think that is helpful. But being very public,
being
on
Larry
King all the time
is
going to be a problem.
Poking you.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
On Thursdays, of course, we talk tech on Thursdays. But I don't know if this is a tech story today.
It's a social story.
I think
it
might be
story.
A sociological story. I mean, remember Barack Obama had a BlackBerry, right? He had it all
right.
During the campaign.
Didn't want to give it up.
Didn't want to give it up, and it was a huge, huge deal. Well, think of the poor Pentagon. Admiral Michael Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, has a Facebook page. The Pentagon is dealing with that. Joining us to talk about the implications of institutions like governments and corporations dealing with social networking is Rachel King, contributing technology writer for Business Week. She joins us from San Francisco. Good morning, Rachel.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
So, we're talking about the government, but it could be a corporation, could even be a small business. I mean, if you've got a business together, you like to think that it's just the public relations department that's writing the memos about your company. But in this era, with Facebook, Twitter, and all these sort of instantaneous social networking sites, virtually everyone in your company could be delivering some message about your institution, right?
Right. And that can be a really great thing, or it can be a really frightening thing, depending on how you approach it.
Well, frightening I get. What's really great about this?
What's really great is that employees or members of the government can really make give a human face to your corporation or your large organization. And they can really connect with people in a way that this large organization simply can't on its own.
But that human face could be scowling. I mean, how do companies control the message coming out from their employees? Or do they try?
That's a really good question. Apparently, a lot of companies think that they should be able to control that message, and they're not able to in most cases. So I think it's really important as a company to decide whether you want your employees to Twitter or not and to communicate that, because a lot of them are already Twittering and you may not know it.
So here is a technical question. Do companies set up a site where they invite their employees to Twitter, or are they just letting people kind of do it willy-nilly?
People are generally just doing it on their own. They set up their own account on Twitter and they just start tweeting away.
Well, the government, as one example, is all over the map on this. I mean, the National Institute of Health, on the one hand, encourages scientists to write, edit Wikipedia entries with their identity. It encourages a certain amount of disclosure on the part of scientists in the interest of academic freedom, I suppose. But it's completely the opposite if you're talking about the Navy. And even within the military, the Army differs from the Navy in whether they want soldiers and generals even blogging.
Yes, the Marines actually banned Twitter for security reasons, but then the other branches of the military encourage it. So the Pentagon is now reviewing that and trying to decide what their policy is going to be. And I think a lot of corporations across America are also trying to decide what their policies are going to be.
Now, you can technically and electronically control all of this on a corporate intranet. But if your identity is known and you're out in a Gmail account or something, someone can find a quote about your boss and put it on their Facebook page. And all of a sudden, it's part of the public record.
And that's the situation, is that Twitter and all of these services are really available on most computers or any, you know, cell phones, mobile phones. And so employees can access that at work, even if your corporate network or your government has decided to shut off access to the services.
Sure. And Rachel, you're a reporter for Business Week. Do you follow Twitters to get scoops? We know that that happens in politics.
Oh, definitely. I really follow I follow a lot of people that I think are interesting, and I've gotten a lot of tips that way. And I know a lot of other journalists do, too. And we also ask for sources and for information that way. We'll put a question out on Twitter, and you'd be surprised the information we just get back.
So it's possible that this is one of the reasons why the White House is struggling to fill its cyber czar post. The question of whether this is even possible to control, I suppose, is really the final sort of tech issue here. I mean, some would say that the complexity and the impulse even to try and control this is an indication that, in fact, the barn door is open, the horses are gone. In fact, people are going to communicate, and it's up to institutions to just sort of figure a new way to either trust their employees or to make their message less subject to manipulation.
Exactly. And one of the best things that you can do as a corporation, if you know your employees are Twittering, is just put guidelines around it. Tell them the kind of behavior you expect if they're going to tweet as, you know, a member of your organization.
Who does this well?
Oh, lots of folks do this well. Dell does this well. Comcast. One of my favorite is online retailer Zappos. The CEO there is extraordinarily funny and engaging. He talks about he goes to the drive-thru at the fast food restaurant and spills his breakfast burrito on his tie. And he is just unbelievably funny. And he's really established an emotional connection with a lot of people. He's got over a million followers, and he has just created this really engaging brand on Twitter.
I was going to say that that sounds like it really humanizes him to his employees and to the public. Now, could there be a nefarious conspiratorial explanation here that businesses know that their employees are going to be sending out emails to gossip sites and all, you know, and use that form of communication, and this way they can keep an eye on their employees?
There might be some of that. I know Ed Zappos, the CEO, really encourages all of his employees to Twitter, but I don't think he's following them. I think what he wants to do is create community within the company. And by getting people to know each other who may not work in the same building or the same location, you can really create a stronger corporate culture that way.
Yes. Well, branding by Twitter, it's a corporate imperative, whether you like it or not. Rachel King, contributing technology writer for Business Week, joined us from San Francisco for Tech Thursday. Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you.
All right, John, let's get a look at some of the top stories we're following today. In Kenya, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is meeting with the interim government of Somalia. Somali Foreign Minister Muhammad Abdulli Omar says his people will welcome any help.
It is absolutely clear that the people of Somalia are tired, sick and tired of war, sick and tired of chaos. We do not wish to live under those conditions anymore.
The Somali government only controls portions of the country. There are fears it may have become a haven for radical militants. Back in the United States, the White House will announce a plan that will put federal regulators in charge of the country's biggest immigration detention centers. Currently, the government contracts the work out to private companies. It's only part of a larger immigration overhaul. John?
So the Senate has a deal. There's a deal on the Cash for Clunkers program, a vote scheduled later today. If it passes, car buyers will have until Labor Day to get their share of the additional, it's estimated, $2 billion to fund the program. Hurricane Felicia has been upgraded to a Category 4 storm, but Jack Bevin with the National Hurricane Center says there's no reason to worry.
Several days down the road, the storm or what's left of it could get near Hawaii, but that time we are expecting it to be significantly reduced in intensity, most likely below hurricane strength.
Right now, Hurricane Felicia is about 1,400 miles west of the Baja Peninsula. Pacific hurricanes are not typically as much of a threat as Atlantic and Caribbean. The man who shot and killed three women and killed himself in a suburban Pittsburgh health club warned of his plans on a web diary. In his blog, the gunman revealed that he hadn't had a girlfriend in 25 years, felt ignored by women despite attempts to improve his appearance. He said the shooting was a plan to get revenge.
That's just some of what we're watching this morning. Judge Sotomayor is expected to be confirmed today. A handful of Republicans will say they'll vote no. Will they feel the fallout? Coming up next.
Political fallout. There you go.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here. So, Amy Holmes, at the end of business today, this we know. Sotomayor, Judge Sotomayor, will be a Associate Justice of the Supreme Court.
The first Hispanic.
First Hispanic. It will be a historic moment for Hispanics.
Yep.
But we're not voting on the nomination, right?
No, we're mere mortals, mere citizens.
Got to be a senator for that. Dr. Juan Andrade, President of the U.S. Hispanic Leadership Institute, you're not voting on the nomination, right?
No, I'm not voting either.
You're not a senator. And Leslie Sanchez, former advisor to President George W. Bush, current CEO of the Impacto Group, a research firm in Washington, D.C. Leslie, you're not voting on the nomination, right?
Not at all.
But voters are really at stake. The nomination of this historic first Hispanic justice on the Supreme Court, we've been told, is a political moment for Hispanics who are looking to either the GOP or the Democrats for a political alliance going forward. Dr. Andrade, do you think that the Democrats or the Republicans will benefit or be hurt by the way they've approached this nomination?
I think it's kind of hard. It's a little early to predict how it might play out as we move forward from this day. And, you know, I think it's important to recognize, as we've begun already, to that this is a very historic day, you know, for the United States and not just for the Latino community. Only the third woman and, of course, the first Hispanic to be nominated and confirmed as an associate justice on the Supreme Court of the United States, and being as how this is a lifetime appointment. And
well, that we certainly know. Well, Leslie Sanchez, is this historic moment that, as Dr. Juan Andrade says, Hispanics will be following closely, translate into votes for the Democrats or votes against Republicans who might vote against Sonia Sotomayor?
Argue that it doesn't. You know, there's a misconception, I think, in definitely in Washington and probably nationally, that it could have larger implications in terms of Hispanic vote turnout in the next 2010, 2012 elections. But I think with respect, if you mirror that or kind of match that to how the senators conducted themselves, how respectful they were in their hearing process and allowed this very fine jurist to explain herself, her positions, I think that it's looking more like a very fair vote based on judicial philosophy and her qualification to do this job. So
right, but
I it's fair.
But just to get the point clearly, you're saying not that it benefits one party or another, but that politically it's a wash. It's not going to be terribly relevant.
Has more to do with the fact that Latino voters are not monolithic.
Right,
they vote their personal interest and not so much their identity.
Leslie, this is Amy Holmes here. Hi, how are you?
Good.
Ralph Reed wrote a very extensive, lengthy memo to the GOP on the political implications of this vote, and he said that Republicans are on very firm ground voting against Sotomayor and that it's actually red state Democrats who might be more at risk. He looked at the numbers of gun owners who oppose the judge. He looked at independents. And, you know, this doesn't look good if you're, say, Mark Pryor in Arkansas. What do you say to that?
I say Ralph's right on that. I mean, if you just look at her as a very qualified jurist, people would say she's a left of center jurist. She has a long history of that. But the bottom line is the objective of the senators to say, look, can she adhere to the rule of law, does she understand the role of the jurist on the Supreme Court? And if she can do those two things, and many Republicans agree that she can meet those criteria, they will vote for her. But on those issues that are very important to some Southern Democrats, you're exactly right.
Well, wait a minute. You can't have it both ways. If it's irrelevant, it's irrelevant. But if it's going to hurt Democrats, that's a totally contradictory position.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, as a senator, you're going to vote based on where your constituency falls and where your own philosophy falls. I'm not going to tell you how these folks are going to vote. But those were the two criteria. You may not like her politics, but if you feel she met those two criteria, she deserves the vote. That's kind of the bottom line of it. I mean, that's where a lot of people hold their nose and may vote for her, but they don't agree with her.
Dr. Juan Andrade, who do you think is more threatened politically by the way they treated Sonia Sotomayor during the confirmation process and in the Senate debate?
Well, I think that Republicans certainly have a stand to lose a great deal by how they vote today. I think, you know, recognizing, of course, the questioning by the Senate that she was questioned fairly and aggressively, but that she handled herself well. And I think established beyond reproach, you know, her impeccable record as a jurist.
Does that mean politically, though, that the video is going to be recording all of the anti-Sotomayor speeches today for the senators who vote against her for campaign commercials in those districts?
That's what's going to count more than anything else. After all has been said and done, you know, what happens today, I think it's really going to speak volumes, and much more than we have seen over the last couple of weeks of hearings in the last several months since she was nominated. What the bottom line is, and what the Latino community, I believe, will look at, is how did they vote at the end of the day? When it all was said and done, how did they vote? They will see this as a vote against our community, a vote against her, and that this is a vote that Republicans will live to regret, because this is just one more step in the wrong direction that they have been following for several years, and that has cost the Latino community dearly and has cost the Republicans even more dearly. And it appears that they're perfectly content in moving in that direction.
Let me get in there. Let me throw out a statistic for you. Zogby found that Hispanic voters themselves were pretty evenly divided about Sotomayor. So do you think that these ads will push that opinion?
No, I think that what we're going to see today is what's going to determine what happens next. That people will see this as a vote against our community, a vote against a very well qualified jurist. Irrespective of the judicial philosophy that some senators may have as opposed to others, that they see this as a rejection of our presence of the Latino community on the Supreme Court of the United States, and that is what Latinos will remember.
Well, it's an opportunity for politicians to exploit it on one side or the other. That's thanks to Dr. Juan Andrade, president of the U.S. Hispanic Leadership Institute, and also Leslie Sanchez, former advisor to President George W. Bush and the CEO of Impacto Group. Sotomayor will be a Supreme Court justice, but the political fallout will take some time to come.
As yet to be seen. Good news on the job market. New claims for unemployment benefits were down last week. The Labor Department says 550,000 people applied for the benefits, but the total number of people on the unemployment payroll was up. Some job hunters could catch a break if the Senate votes today to keep the cash for clunkers rebate running through Labor Day. Automakers are hinting that they'll boost production and bring back some laid-off workers if the extra cash comes through.
While you're applying for a job, just sell your car. And there you go. The president's got a new deadline for health care reform. He's calling for action by the end of the year. Could be risky. He says he'll get it without GOP support. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton meets with leaders from Somalia today. She's expected to endorse the country's interim government, which only controls a portion of the country. And an Afghanistan official say 21 people on their way to a wedding were killed by a roadside bomb. That's a look at some of the morning's top stories. Coming up later this hour, Afghans go to the polls this month in the war-torn country. We'll assess Hamid Karzai's chances in that election. He's the favorite. Coming up.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Amy Holmes. John, terrible headlines out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I'm sure you saw the story. A man named George Sodini went to a gym outside of Pittsburgh, and he opened fire, hitting 12 women, killing three of them. But there was some explanation provided on his blog where he detailed his personal problems. Joining me now is Dr. Michael Wellner, a forensic psychiatrist and adjunct law professor at Duquesne University in Pittsburgh, who has studied mass murderers. Dr. Wellner, do you have some insights into what happened last night?
Well, I think the most important thing for your audience to realize is that whatever's on the blog and these videos don't portray anything about him. Mass shooting, like suicide bombing, actually, has one a very key quality that we don't see anywhere else in crime, and that is it's crime that's carried out specifically. So we talk about it on this radio program, and so this man, who is otherwise forgotten and actually a sexual reject, becomes famous. And it's a crime all about getting notoriety. It is the unusual crime in which more attention is put into how he's going to be portrayed after the fact than planning the crime itself.
Which means
and
he
so,
may not so actually
this, this
be...
This blog may have even been edited.
Right. I mean, he may not be a sexual reject. I mean, it's hard to evaluate anything that was on the blog there.
Well, I'll tell you why he may be a sexual reject, because in my experience, and I've probably interviewed and examined more mass shooters who've survived than anybody that you'll speak to in the United States, I can tell you that one common thread, which is a fascinating a tragedy, is that these are individuals who either through repression or just sexual incompetence have such great difficulty establishing a romantic and sexual connection with women, and they divert all of that energy into masculine role models of destruction. And that is the common pathway. It's not that every rejected male is going to go out and grab a gun, but for every rejected male who chronically finds himself isolated and helpless for his own limitations, who's alienated and increasingly resentful and feels righteous about it and blames everyone else, recognizing that the attention-seeking qualities of being so destructive and how our society values fame here in America, it's a common pathway that sadly our cultural icons feed into.
So
that's why we see it here.
But here's my question. I guess I don't really understand. Is there some underlying psychiatric condition that, you know, inspires someone to be this narcissistic, grandiose, revenge-seeking? I mean, is there something sort of deeper and more fundamental?
Well, you know, depending on, in that sense, one can no longer generalize. I will tell you this, the end point is hopelessness. That's one thing about the blog that is actually well illustrated. Here is someone who writes, well, if I lose my job, then that will pretty much be it for me because things will never get better. These shootings happen, and typically not when someone snaps, but when, in a rather anticlimactic way, the person responds to even a mild rejection and decides, you know what, things are not going to get any better. So I am going to go out and I'm going to assume this notorious, larger-than-life personality. And so hopelessness is probably the most important psychiatric factor as opposed to an actual condition.
Dr. Some Wellner,
of these individuals are paranoid,
Wellner,
some are depressed.
Sorry to cut you off. It's fascinating stuff, and we'd love to have you back to talk more about it, to try to understand these folks among us. That was Dr. Michael Wellner, a forensic psychiatrist.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here. Let's begin by checking in on some of the top stories we're watching this morning.
Let's check it out. The White House is expected to announce a plan that puts the country's biggest immigration detention centers in the hands of federal regulators. Currently, the government contracts the work out to private companies. The Senate votes today on the nomination of Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor. She has the support of a handful of Republicans. Senator Kit Bond of Missouri got on board just yesterday.
I do not believe that the Constitution tells me that I should refuse to support her merely because I disagree with her on some cases.
Should be noted that Senator Bond is a conservative. Sotomayor also enjoys the support of the Democratic majority. Her confirmation is expected to go through easily.
So it's a Category 4 storm now, Hurricane Felicia moving off the coast of Mexico. The National Hurricane Center says the storm in the Pacific will calm down before it reaches Hawaii. Pregnant woman accused of drug trafficking in Laos will serve her sentence in Britain, where she's from. Her crime would usually be punishable by death, but Laos does not execute pregnant women. Laotian officials say that while she may have artificially inseminated herself because she became pregnant while in jail. Award-winning screenwriter Bud Schulberg has died. Schulberg wrote What Makes Sammy Run and the Oscar-winning On the Waterfront. Here's Marlon Brando as the film's fallen prizefighter hero.
You don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody instead of a bum.
Will you point at me?
Which is what I am.
Bud Schulberg was a contender. He was 95 and he died at his home on Long Island, New York. And that's a look at some of the top stories this morning.
We've been reporting on what we call Obama's war in Afghanistan. The latest this morning, a roadside bomb killed 20 people just as the new NATO Secretary General is on his second day of a three-day trip to the southern part of Afghanistan. With us is Anand Gopal, Wall Street Journal reporter, joining us from Kabul. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what do we know is the latest with the bombing?
Well, there's about 21 people who are in a tractor trailer and hit a roadside bomb, all civilians, all of them killed. And this is part of a rising trend of increasing civilian casualties this year. Civilian casualties have increased by 24% according to the United Nations. Casualties caused both by insurgents and by foreign forces.
Now, is this all in anticipation of the upcoming elections on the 20th? Is it to try to influence the outcome?
Well, this is part of the uptick in violence this summer. There's been an increase in the number of international troops here, and with that, there's been an increase in roadside bombs targeting these troops. And this particular incident happened in the southern province of Helmand, where there's currently a marine offensive trying to clear areas ahead of the elections. So in that sense, it is related, but it's part of a larger uptick in violence.
So we're hearing rumors that the elections may not take place at all because of this violence. What are you reporting?
Well, there's a lot of polling centers in the south and in the east, the most violent areas, which may be closed because they're just too insecure or unstable. This would probably amount to about 10% of the total number of centers. So that's, the elections probably still will take place, but you're facing a large numbers of people in these affected areas may not get the chance to go and vote.
Well, of course, the question for U.S. policymakers is whether or not President Hamid Karzai can handle responsibility and what's going to be happening at the polls. With us to talk about that is Elizabeth Rubin, contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, who has a very big story out this weekend about her 3 days with the Afghani president. It's a fascinating, vivid portrayal of politics and the people in Afghanistan. And as Afghanis go to the poll, the key question then again is, is Hamid Karzai, the Afghani president, really up for the job? Elizabeth, what are your thoughts?
Well, it's a million-dollar question. You know, he's done the job for the past 5 years, and I think for the past 3 years, people have grown very unhappy with him and have been frustrated by his inability to crack down on corruption, by his inability to really have a vision for the country and carry through with it.
So, Elizabeth, you spent 3 days with Hamid Karzai. What were your impressions of the man, and what was the reaction of citizens to him? Was he out there pressing the flesh? Was he in a security bubble? Can you give us a little sense of that?
When I was there, which was, and I met with him in December and in February, throughout his presidency, he has been very isolated, particularly in the last 3 or 4 years. He doesn't go out that much. Basically, he sits in the palace and he has elders from different provinces come to meet him in the afternoon for long lunches. And most of the politicking is conducted from inside the palace.
I see. So you write in your piece that his reelection team is called the Warlord Ticket. Can you explain that?
Right. Yes. He made a very strange and many would say unfortunate move in choosing Marshal Fahim as his vice president. He was the minister of defense in his early part of his tenure, Karzai's, and everybody tried to get him to remove him because he was associated with the Northern Alliance, which were our partners in fighting the Taliban. But many of those people were the old warlords, which is to say they ran little fiefdoms around the country. They have wielded power through intimidation, money, killing, really anything to stay in power and to defeat their enemies. And they continued with this kind of politics once the so-called democracy was brought in.
So do you think Karzai is justified in having that opinion, or at least that spin?
I mean, at that time, absolutely. There's no question. But there were times after that when he started to rely on them more out of not knowing else how else to create a movement for himself, because he had isolated himself from so many people in the country, and he had no political party, and he really had no grassroots movement. We installed Karzai.
But are there really any credible alternatives? CNN says there are only really 2 men out of 40 who have any chance of challenging him in this election, and their popularity is only in the double, or hasn't even broken double digits, actually.
That's the thing about Afghanistan, which is it's not a very, you know, there's not a lot of television. Basically, I would say 70% of the country relies on radio. You earn a lot by just being known. And Karzai's been known. He's been in power for 8 years. Both of the candidates who are the top two of the 40, that is Dr. Abdullah Abdullah and Dr. Ashraf Ghani, both of them, I think, would be great alternatives. The problem is, can they get elected? Also, you know, Karzai is, he's got the levers of power all over the country. So in remote places, there's 7,000 polling stations that are going to have counting. There's no way there's going to be monitors all over the place. People are going to be stuffing ballot boxes for him.
Well, we'll certainly be watching that very closely here at The Takeaway. Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us. That was Elizabeth Rubin, who has a fascinating piece in the New York Times Magazine this weekend on her 3 days with Hamid Karzai. I encourage you to read it.
He's certainly the incumbent. One more question now for Anand Gopal of The Wall Street Journal in Kabul. Anand, I mean, what is the mission of this violence today? Is it targeted at Karzai and the sense of stability politically in Afghanistan? Or are there pushbacks militarily because of the offensive going on in Helmand province?
Well, it's a little bit of both. The violence is targeted towards the international troops in places like Helmand, but it's also regularly directed towards all representatives of the government. Today, there was also a roadside bomb that killed a few police officers in Helmand province. And that way, they're trying to create a sense amongst local people that the government cannot protect them, or the government security. And by doing that, they're hoping to erode the support of the government. And they've been largely successful in doing that over the last couple of years.
Anand, thank you for joining us from Kabul. That was Anand Gopal, Wall Street Journal reporter.
Well, it's certainly not hard to erode a sense of political stability in Afghanistan, that's for sure. But speaking of stability, Paula Abdul is leaving American Idol. Are you sorry to see her go? What other famous person would you like to say goodbye to? How about...
How many years is it after Beverly Hills 90210? And I'm still bitter that I know who Tori Spelling is. Go away.
Not going to happen there, Troy. Ouch, but wait, there's more.
I'd like to say goodbye to Kim Kardashian. I've seen enough of her. She doesn't do anything.
Kim Kardashian, television socialite, daughter of O.J. Simpson's lawyer. That's not a job description.
Star of a sex tape.
Yeah, there you go. So the question is, if you're famous for being famous and it's time for you to say goodbye, who would you like to jettison from our planet who's just famous for being famous? Paula Abdul is leaving American Idol. Some people say she's actually famous. Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. If you missed anything, we are always on here at The Takeaway, of course. You can take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes. And here's your takeaway.
There is the cultural demand to go back to normal, but we just don't do that. And if there is the pressure to do that, it stands in the way of recovery.
There is no path back to normal, according to Dr. Yael Danieli, clinical psychologist and trauma specialist, talking about the complicated recovery possibly facing Una Lee and Laura Ling. That was on the program earlier this morning.
You know, I'd like to nominate Kate and John.
Kate and John.
That's possible.
Oh, famous people for being famous to go away?
Right, yes.
Not Laura Ling and Una Lee. They actually are famous for getting kidnapped in North Korea.
Well, I'm Amy Holmes.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
In a desperate predicament, desperate measures.
What happened?
He jettisoned the fuel and ignited it.
You need that fuel to maintain orbit. Are you out of your mind?
Perhaps, Mr. Bowman.
How long have we got now, Scotty?
The orbit will start decaying as soon as the fuel's exhausted. Say 6 minutes.
The government has burned off its stimulus fuel, lowered interest rates, printed money, and even paid people to buy cars. Can we see recovery? Mr. Spock, what do we do?
I examined the problem from all angles, and it was plainly hopeless. Logic informed me that, under the circumstances, the only possible action would have to be one of desperation.
The science of desperation. What if an economy threw a recovery and didn't invite you? If a recession ends in the forest and nobody hears it, does it make a sound? Economics 101, that's our philosophy on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Jobless Schmombless. It's Thursday, August 6th. I'm John Hockenberry here with Amy Holmes. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning. Coming up this hour, John, we have a number of stories. The Treasury turf war. Who's in charge with these new regulations? Former John Bolton is here to be talking
former
about
John.
That.
He's current John Bolton.
Former ambassador, pardon me. And you know what? John Bolton does not approve of Bill Clinton's mission this week, and we're going to be hearing more about that. Paula Abdul, please say it ain't so.
Yeah, she's leaving American Idol, minus one idol. But first, our idol. Joining us now is University of Maryland economist Peter Morici. Peter, thanks for coming back to the show. You need to help me personally here. I'm having trouble, economically speaking, with this word recovery. When do we get to say something more tangible, like prosperity?
The economy will start to grow again in the fourth quarter or the beginning of next year. But in terms of people feeling better, a better jobs market, not till at least the end of 2010. They're going to see gas prices rise before they see wages rise.
Great. Peter Morici, we'll talk to you more about this in a minute, but just let's look at the headlines first.
In those headlines, we've got fresh numbers on the job market. New claims for unemployment benefits were down last week. The Labor Department says 550,000 people applied for the benefits.
Take that, Peter Morici.
In Washington, the Senate votes today on whether to triple the cash for clunkers fund. Automakers are hinting that they'll boost production and bring back some laid-off workers if the extra cash comes through.
The president's cracking the old health care whip. He's got a new deadline.
I promise you, we will pass reform by the end of this year because the American people need it. The American people need some relief.
Promises, promises. The president made that declaration in Indiana yesterday. He meets with members of the Senate Finance Committee from both parties today to talk health care. You can go to our website, by the way, takeaway.org, to check out our primer on health care reform 101. Todd Zwillick breaks down all the plans floating through Congress, including what the Senate is dealing with in the Finance Committee. Overseas, Afghan officials say at least 21 people on their way to a wedding were killed by a roadside bomb in the country's south. The explosion happened as the new NATO head was in the region to assess conditions on the ground. Markets mostly flat yesterday. The Nasdaq closed down about 1%. The Dow opens this hour at 92.81. The S&P starts trading at 10.03, and the Nasdaq begins at 19.93. It's controversy. Paula Abdul, what is she famous for? Some people say she's a hit maker. She's a hugely talented dancer and choreographer, but I say she's famous merely for being famous. Are you sorry to see her go? Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email, mytake@thetakeaway.org. Who else who's famous for being famous would you like to jettison?
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning. This is Amy Holmes. We have Peter Morici on the phone with us, business professor at the University of Maryland. So, Peter, we've been asking a takeaway question all morning. Who should be kicked out of the celebrity circus? Who do you say?
I'd like to get rid of Jamie Dimon over at J.P. Morgan. I mean, those J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs together are holding up the recovery. They're choking the economy.
He's famous for being a banker.
That's right. He's the banker's banker. He's one of the most outspoken guys on Wall Street and very tough for Barack Obama to deal with. He's extraordinarily arrogant.
But I have to ask, so he's famous for CNBC?
Well, he's famous in my world, you know, that circle of, you know, people that talk about, you know, the economy on CNBC and Fox Business and places like that.
And we made you famous, Peter, right?
That's right. You did.
Yeah,
you did.
That's right.
So, Peter, tomorrow some big, some say ugly numbers are coming out about unemployment. What are you predicting?
Well, we're going to jump unemployment to 9.7% perhaps, and we're going to lose another 350,000 jobs. We'll be lucky if it's only that. Those numbers simply have to come down, or Barack Obama's in a lot of trouble, not just on restoring recovery, but getting things like his health care policy through. It's becoming increasingly apparent that he's been focusing on the wrong ball, dividing up the pie instead of worrying about the fact that the pie is disappearing completely.
Well, we actually have two people here to talk about the crumbs of that pie. Peter, stay on the phone. Josen Cummings joins us here in the studio. Josen, you lost your job as an editor at Vibe magazine, is that correct?
Correct.
We also have Wayne Cooper, who's calling in from Clearwater, Florida. He's a commercial printing technician. He was laid off just last week from a job that he's had for over 20 years. Wayne, let's start with you. Why were you let go? What was the reason given?
Company had to file for bankruptcy, and they couldn't come up with a plan that would actually help them come out of it, so they ended up closing their doors.
So this must be a tremendous shock for you. How are you handling it?
It's shaky, you know. It's like sometimes it hasn't really completely set in. You know, I was working in Florida for 23 years, but I have also done the same work in Massachusetts 10 years prior. So I've been doing this for 34 years. And, you know, you're at the point where you had a job in the field that you went to college for, worked for 34 years. You're almost in the mode for, like, I'm coasting to retirement. And then all of a sudden you lose your job and you find out that there aren't any out there to replace it. And I'm almost at the point where it's like I'm not even sure that I want to do it again after 34 years. I'm at the point now where I think I need to do something totally different, where I'm my own boss and where I can't get fired.
Well, Wayne Cooper, I mean, you got the triple whammy there. You've got, first of all, a layoff in your own business, but your company is bankrupt and your industry is really evaporating away. The same could be said for you, Josen Cummings. I mean, Vibe magazine is just emblematic of the magazine industry itself going away. I mean, that's like two traumas at least there, it seems.
Definitely. It was a complete shock. Being at Vibe magazine did kind of occupy this unique space in the magazine market. Nobody really thought that it would go the way that it did, but everything happened quickly.
Well, given that the media as a job market is shrinking, that's so tough. Are you reconsidering being a journalist?
No, I'm not reconsidering being a journalist. You know, I've only been doing it professionally for 5 years when I graduated from college, so I'm still fairly young in the industry. I still have a lot of passion for it. And the journalism industry that I kind of went to school for, the traditional print, radio, television models, you know, those things.
There's something still around.
Yeah,
it's moving pretty fast.
So you're optimistic.
I'm definitely optimistic.
But it's interesting to me that you don't necessarily think about changing, whereas Wayne Cooper out there in Clearwater, Florida, is at the end of his career and is thinking about changing. Wayne, I'm assuming you're not imagining going to sell things at Walmart, are you?
No, I'm not going to become a Walmart greeter just yet, but I am thinking about maybe starting a house cleaning business.
Interesting. So
yeah, it's being that it's only happened a week ago, there are a lot of possibilities going around, but it probably would be some type of a small business.
I see. So do you have a spouse who is helping you, you know, pick up the slack?
No, I don't.
Oh, so you're really relying on yourself and whether or not a paycheck comes in each month.
Yes, you know, and I've always saved, you know, so I'm not worried about that just yet.
Well, that's good for you.
Kind of disturbing, you know, that the money that I have been saving was supposed to be for my retirement, and like so many others, we're tapping into it just to get by.
So, Peter, you're in a boat with many other journalists. Are you sharing stories? Are you sharing job leads?
We're definitely doing what we can. A lot of us are doing what we can. People are sticking together. And just looking out there to see what's available. I mean, living in New York City, you meet a lot of freelance writers.
You know? Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, you meet them at Starbucks on the wireless. Josen Cummings, Wayne Cooper, seemed to me, Peter Morici, to be examples of data points in this jobless recovery that you've talked about, that we've talked about repeatedly on this program. Their businesses are going away. Their industries are in such flux that the notion of retraining doesn't necessarily even apply. Peter, would you agree?
It certainly makes it very difficult because they'd be hit two different ways. One, the recession itself, which is making the economy permanently smaller, This is the Great Recession, not any just any recession. And the other is technological change, which is shifting demand away from the industries they work in because people are going to the internet and away from print media. You know, it's affecting just the sheer number of journalism jobs that would be available if we were back to the good old days of 2007. Recessions tend to hasten the consequences of technological change.
Sobering news. Peter Morici, thank you for joining the show. I want to thank Josen Cummings, a former editor at Vibe, Wayne Cooper, who was recently laid off from his press pre-press printing, and thank you so much for sharing your stories.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Voices behind the economic indicators.
The reality.
Certainly a mission on this program. Well, one of the very abstract sort of economic phenomena is in Washington, the debate that's taking place now over how to regulate the economy to prevent the financial meltdown that we were reporting on just a few months ago. Joining us now is Stephen Labaton, reporter who covers regulatory issues for our partners, the New York Times. He joins us from Washington. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, John.
So the Obama administration rolled out this new regulatory regime. Timothy Geithner talked about it, a sort of financial consumer protection regulatory regime, but it really is shaping up as involving a certain amount of competition between the Federal Reserve and the Department of the Treasury. Now we add to that that the financial industry itself doesn't seem to want to back this new regulatory regime. What's the chance that interagency fighting and lobbying against this is going to derail the entire new regulatory program that Obama really staked his economic future on?
That's the concern of Treasury Secretary Geithner and his supporters and consumer organizations and labor organizations who are lobbying to get this done, that the fight over the regulators, which in some ways is channeling the industry opposition to this, could either dilute it or kill it.
Does Geithner think, and you spoke with him yesterday, that things are starting to unravel here?
No, he still sounds very confident that this will get accomplished, or at least the broad objectives, and particularly this new consumer protection agency. But he also feels, and he told me, you know, look, he said, I'm comfortable taking the high ground on this. If they want to fight over whether consumers should be protected in a way we think they'll be vigorously protected, I'm happy to make that fight.
You know, the Bush administration engaged in an extraordinary interagency battle in forming the Homeland Security Department, which involved combining all kinds of agencies and making coherent lines of authority that had traditionally been all over the map in Washington. It seems like the Obama administration has not created a kind of uber regulatory agency, but is going to maintain the competition that exists between all these other agencies. It seems hard to imagine that this can work.
It's a very difficult process. I think in an ideal world, the people who want to reform the system would love to have one banking agency instead of four. But as you can see from just this debate and argument and industry opposition to this one proposal to create a consumer agency, it is enormously politically difficult in Washington to consolidate and move the boxes around. Different congressional committees have different jurisdictions in some areas, different industry sectors with a lot of influence like their regulator and don't want to be re-regulated by a different regulator. It's a very hard political fight to win.
But given all that, quickly, the takeaway here is Geithner's still optimistic, right?
That's what he says.
Keeping a smiling face on it, Stephen Labaton interviewed Timothy Geithner, head of the Treasury Department, yesterday. Stephen Labaton is a reporter who covers regulatory issues for our partners, the New York Times. So, you know, voices of unemployment there at the top of the segment, and then the voice of the financial recovery, Timothy Geithner, trying to put a smiling face on what is clearly turning out to be a fairly chaotic battle over how the financial sector is going to be re-regulated.
Seems so.
Yeah.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
record.
We were very clear that this was a humanitarian mission. Mm-hmm. President Clinton was going on behalf of the families to get these young journalists out. We have said to the North Koreans, there's a path for improved relations, and it involves them no longer developing nuclear weapons and not engaging in the provocative behavior that they've been engaging in.
That was President Obama talking on MSNBC yesterday. John, you've been raising the question all week. Who really benefits from this? Is the United States, North Korea? Is this a case of the tail wagging the big dogs?
Well,
so
the president says there's a path to better relations with North Korea, but apparently that path leads through Pyongyang.
Well, we have John Bolton here to discuss that. He is the former ambassador to the United Nations, and he has some pretty strong thoughts. Welcome. You say that Clinton's efforts come perilously close to negotiating with terrorists. That's pretty strong stuff. What do you mean?
Well, I don't think it's actually all that strong. I mean, what North Korea did in seizing these journalists, staging a show trial for them, and then sentencing them to 12 years at hard labor is essentially the same as kidnapping. I don't know why these journalists were inside North Korea. It was a foolish thing to do. I assume we'll find out more about that in due course. But they hardly constituted a threat to the security of North Korea. I think North Korea knew from the outset, once it had these ladies, that they would be pawns in a larger strategic struggle with the United States, and they have played them exactly that way.
But what were our options then in dealing with North Korea to rescue and release Laura Ling and Una Lee?
Well, obviously, everybody's happy to get them out, but, you know, we have had in this country for decades, literally decades, a fully bipartisan policy of not negotiating with terrorists. And the reason for that policy, particularly in a hostage situation, is that you don't want to encourage those terrorists or other terrorists to think that Americans are on the bargaining block, that if they can kidnap a few, they'll get rewarded for it.
Well, wait a minute on the kidnapping thing, John Bolton. I mean, I'm no advocate for the North Koreans, but, I mean, come on. If two North Koreans wandered into the Pentagon with cameras and started taking pictures, they'd probably get arrested in the United States. That's not terrorism, is it? Or kidnapping?
Sir, we don't know the full details, but as I understand it, these ladies walked across the very narrow, shallow river defining the Russian-North Korean border. That is hardly the same thing as being in the Pentagon. A civilized country would have given them a figurative wrist slap and sent them out of the country. Obviously, North Korea did precisely the opposite. And even if there was to be a penalty involved, do you believe 12 years at hard labor is appropriate?
Well, it's for the North Koreans to decide, not me.
Oh, I can't believe you just said that. They walk across the border into North Korea, and that gets 12 years of hard labor. I mean, if you think
I'm just saying it's not kidnapping, that's all.
Of course it is. They held them against their will in a grossly disproportionate fashion.
Like a lot of people at Gitmo.
I think the ladies were not. I mean, if you
don't want to go down this road, Bolton.
If you want to equate these two ladies with fanatic terrorists fighting us in Afghanistan, be my guest.
But let's get back to your issue, your contention that the approach here was faulty, and you're saying, you know, clearly 12 years of hard labor is egregious and extraordinary. So how could we have gotten them out without, you know, sending Bill Clinton at Kim Jong-il's request?
Well, I think we have to start with what I thought we were in agreement on, but perhaps we're not. And let me ask you the question, do you believe we should negotiate with terrorists?
Well, I take your point that there is certainly a risk of copycats out there.
How about your partner? Does he believe in negotiating with terrorists?
Well, you'd have to ask him.
We're talking about North Korea here. The way
that
you
exactly
deal with
point.
North
that's,
Korea
that
is
precisely my point.
But this quid pro quo business, whether you're talking six-party talks or bilateral talks, people have been talking to the North Koreans for a generation.
There is a larger issue here. People all over the world have watched this phenomenon, and they have been making judgments about how to deal with the United States based on this particular scenario. One of the reasons you don't negotiate with terrorists is because of the larger precedent that it sets. So when you face a hostage situation, as for example in the case of hostages held in Lebanon during the Reagan administration, you want to respond in a way that doesn't increase the risk to other Americans overseas.
And not sell weapons to the Iranians, right, during the Iran-Contra affair, right?
Now, in the case of Iran-Contra, Reagan did bargain with terrorists, and that's exactly the kind of outcome we got. we don't, this is not an abstract debate here. We have three Americans who are now being held inside Iran by Iranian security forces, and they have been accused by political figures in Iran already of being CIA agents. This at the very time when the government of Iran has well over 100 dissidents on trial, the predicate for that prosecution being that the dissidents are in fact themselves tools of foreign powers. So the risk to Americans here is not hypothetical. It's not abstract. It's very, very concrete. And a president has to take into account the larger picture of the safety of Americans, protecting Americans from terrorist attacks and abductions generally.
Ambassador, let's look at that question, though, of terrorist organizations versus these rogue nations. In both the cases of North Korea and Iran, these were Americans who wandered into this territory. Are you suggesting that these countries might actually stage events to abduct Americans?
You will recall Iran's the people now governing Iran seized our embassy in 1979. And held the occupants of the embassy hostage for over 400 days. The fact is, when civilized countries find people who have done something foolish, which I'd be happy to stipulate right at the get-go that the hitchhikers in Iran and these journalists did by coming near a border like that, what they do is they may hold them for a few days, but they immediately turn them back across the border that they came from. This sort of thing is barbarous behavior, uncivilized behavior. It is an act of terrorism. The North Koreans in particular have been kidnapping Japanese citizens and South Korean citizens for decades
and have refused
to give accountings to those two governments.
Thank you so much for joining us, Ambassador. That was Ambassador John Bolton, former Ambassador of the United Nations, joining us. And now, on to some more headlines. John?
The Obama administration will announce plans today to put federal workers in charge of detention centers for immigrants facing deportation. Since 2007, private contractors have been doing the job. A new economic indicator out this morning, new applications for unemployment benefits were down last week to 550,000. In Nigeria, the government's offer of amnesty for militants begins today. The government hopes about 10,000 armed men will surrender their weapons in return for a pardon and retraining. And a Charles Manson follower convicted of trying to assassinate President Gerald Ford will be paroled from a Texas prison later this month. Lynette Squeaky Fromm was 26 when she aimed a gun at President Ford in 1975. Secret Service agents wrestled it away.
Coming up next, the bad economy is having an effect on the living and also the dead. A somewhat morbid economic indicator we'll be talking about coming up.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here. Amy Holmes. So we did it at the top of the hour, getting some sort of human voices behind the employment figures that we're waiting for later on in the week. But we also try to find economic indicators, the human dimension behind economic indicators all over the country.
We do. And that's why we've brought in Charlie LaDuff. He is a reporter with Detroit News, and he has a very human and very morbid story about the recession. Welcome, Charlie. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. Good morning.
So you discovered that in Detroit at the morgues, bodies are piling up. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, I didn't discover it. They're kind of sitting there, and I think the doctor's with us. It's his job every day. I just kind of went for a tour. But yeah, in a nutshell, you know, those on the lower rungs can't afford to bury grandpa. I guess there's a guy ping-ponging around in the morgue who's been there a couple of years. His family's promising, you know, we're going to get him out, just hold him. We're trying to squirrel the money away for the funeral, and that ship never seems to come in. So we've got about 50 50 unclaimed people there right now, 30 of which are in this mix we're talking about.
And you said they've been there a couple of years?
Well, there's a couple been there a couple of years.
Well, Dr. Carl Schmidt, Wayne County Medical Examiner, how unprecedented is that? 54 unclaimed bodies for, it sounds like, from Charlie Duff, economic reasons.
We've never seen that before. But keep in mind that these are not people, these are not all 30 people that came in yesterday. Some are 2 years old, some are 6 months old, and some are only a couple of months old. And eventually we will resolve what happens with most of them.
Dr. Schmidt, are you having conversations then with the families who tell you, you know, can you hang on to this while we try to save the money to deal with the situation?
Yes, that's what happens most of the time.
And what do they tell you? I mean, what is their demeanor?
Well, it varies. Some people are ashamed to come to the office and tell us they can't afford to arrange a funeral. Some people don't care. And then there's the people who are out just to make a buck. Some people aren't picked up because they left no money behind.
So I have to ask you a, you know, uncomfortable, at least for me, question. What happens to these bodies?
Well, there is a process, and this is the reason why some of them are there for some time. Actually, the main reason why most of them are there for some time, where the state has to do due diligence. We have to go to the public administrator. They have to look at their estate. They have to assess whether or not there is any money left in bank accounts, that kind of thing. Part of that will be used to bury the body, and then the state also has to track down relatives and dispose of their possessions.
Wow. Well, that's a grim process. Well, it takes time, but it seems to me that for both of you, and let me just throw this back to Charlie and Dr. Schmidt, please comment if you like. I mean, you got that story in Chicago, right, of the cemetery where economic conditions and a sense of corruption suddenly turned the whole sanctity of the dead into an economic opportunity. I mean, here you've got the sanctity of the dead violated by another form of economic stress. Charlie, it's a real commentary on the severity of this recession, it seems to me.
Yeah, we're a mess, man. I mean, that's what it is in the end. To me, my opinion is, death doesn't really matter to the dead. They're dead. They don't know, right? But what it is taking care of the dead, the sanctity, as you said, is a promise to each other that we're going to see each other through till we go into the ground. And too often, more times than not, I'm starting to see what I think sort of a breakdown in society where we're not even caring about the dead. You know what I mean? They're frozen in ice. And we leave them there. We leave them in the coolers. We can do better than this if we're broke or not. That's my opinion.
So did you speak to these families to find out from them, Charlie,
no,
how they feel about this? I mean,
nah.
I take your point, this breakdown in civility.
Well, there's also a breakdown in newspapers. So, like, how long are you supposed to work on a story? You know what I mean? I got to go back to work today and write some more stuff.
Well, Carl, Dr. Carl Schmidt, you've had encounters with the family. You described it a little bit to Amy there. I mean, it's all over the map. People's excuses and shame seems to be a real motivator to actually not come in. How complicated is the city's process and the state's process in tracking people down if they don't want to admit that this is even a problem?
It's not complicated. It's just that it can take time to track someone down. And if someone tells us to please wait while they get their affairs in order, then we have to respect their wishes. And even though there is an undertone here of the breaking down of a social contract, ultimately that's one of the functions we have. It's not explicit, but we try to help keep together whatever is left of that social contract with the dead. And ours is not such a bad place to remain in, considering the alternatives.
That's an interesting point, Dr. Schmidt. I understand that you're a very spiritual person. So how do you make sense of these abandoned people there in your morgue?
Yeah, go ahead, doctor. You are.
Well, there's not much to make sense. It's really practical. As Charlie said, the dead don't really know they're there, and and I suppose that's fine. But I think we do have a social contract with each other that is implicit in our day-to-day discourse. And when you can't bury a relative, that is a breakdown in that.
Charlie, one last word from you on this story that you brought to the takeaway.
All right, let me quickly. This county used to completely pay for it. The county went broke. The state used to pay more. The state went broke. Hey, Washington, send us a couple of bucks so we can bury the dead, maybe. You know what I mean?
And
cash for corpses.
Hey, Detroit News, give Charlie another day to actually talk to the family. So I guess, right?
I'll get to him, you know. It's all I'm just joking around.
I want to thank our guests for joining us. That was Charlie LaDuff, reporter with the Detroit News, and Dr. Carl Schmidt of Wayne County Medical Examiner from Detroit. And John, let's look at those headlines once again.
Well, we got Secretary of State Hillary Clinton pledging U.S. support for Somalia's interim government, which is struggling to regain control of most of the country from militants, including parts of the capital. Back in the U.S., federal regulators are ordering plane maker Boeing to make safety adjustments to the fuel tanks of more than 400 Boeing 767s, part of an effort to prevent mid-flight explosions.
Something I think we can appreciate.
Yeah, I'm all for that.
And a judge is telling Bank of America, not so fast. A judge has ordered a hearing on the proposed settlement between the SEC and Bank of America over executive bonuses because he says the settlement doesn't determine the truth of the allegations against the bank. This week, Bank of America agreed to pay a penalty to settle charges that it misled investors about bonuses paid to Merrill Lynch employees before the companies joined. But Bank of America didn't admit wrongdoing as a part of the settlement. Back overseas, Afghan officials say at least 21 people on their way to a wedding were killed by a roadside bomb in the country's south. The explosion happened as the new NATO head was in the region to assess conditions on the ground.
One wedding, 21 funerals. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning. And Paula Abdul is leaving the American Idol judges table forever. Our girl, no more, saying goodbye to Paula. Maybe she'll become a Supreme Court justice later this hour. Stay with us.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Amy Holmes.
And I'm John Hockenberry, and there were plenty of thank yous to go around yesterday in Burbank.
Una and I would just like to express our deepest gratitude to President Clinton and his wonderful, amazing, not to mention super cool team.
Of course, Laura Ling and Una Lee released yesterday from North Korea because of Bill Clinton. But the thank you we didn't hear perhaps was the thank you from John Podesta, who bounded down onto the tarmac in Burbank right behind President Bill Clinton. Why was he on the trip? Former chief of staff of Bill Clinton and a member of the transition team, actually head of the transition team for Barack Obama. Joel Gerstein joins us now, White House reporter for Politico. So Podesta suddenly in the limelight there. What did you make of that yesterday, Josh?
Yeah, I mean, you know, he's not a guy who's spent a lot of time in the limelight, even though he's someone who's had a lot of impressive titles. But he really is someone who worked his way up in the Clinton White House from the staff secretary position all the way up to chief of staff eventually at the end of that administration.
And his current title is head of the Center for American Progress, a sort of mega think tank in Washington, D.C.
And one that he started basically from scratch about 5 or 6 years ago. I mean, it's not one that's been around for 50 or 60 years or longer. So
was Podesta tagging along here, or what are we seeing is Bill Clinton and John Podesta as kind of Clinton Inc. Emerging from that airplane?
I think there's an element of that. I think what the White House's interest here was that it was bad enough, frankly, that they had to do what was seen as rewarding North Korea in order to get these women out by sending President Clinton over there, and they wanted to find someone of some intellectual and policy heft to send along with the president who wouldn't have the sort of gleaming public profile of another former official, say like Secretary of State Albright or former Secretary James Baker and so forth. So someone that they could have sit next to Clinton who would be a serious person.
Sure, but yeah. Josh, there are lots of, less famous people who work at the White House. I mean, you don't have to go outside of the White House to get someone who's low, under the radar.
Well, Well, but they don't want to send a current official. I mean, their whole claim, the Obama administration's claim, is that this was a unofficial humanitarian gesture, and if they sent a current official, then it's suddenly an official negotiation between the U.S. government.
So, well, Josh, let's talk about that. That's a delicate dance. I mean, is it possible that John Podesta has been designated the unofficial official person that they will send to meetings like this? Administrations famously keep people in the background who they can say are deniably private citizens but are actually working for the administration.
I mean, we've heard those kinds of stories about a lot of people, not just Podesta. We've heard them even about people like Henry Kissinger and so forth who have been traveling overseas in recent months. I think it's possible, but I'm told by my sources within the sort of the Clinton apparatus that Bill Clinton is the one who selected Podesta to go with him. So as far as I know, I don't think, Podesta has great ties to the top staff echelon of the Obama administration. I don't know that he has great, great ties to Obama personally. I don't think they have any problems. But I haven't seen a signal yet that he's going to emerge as the globe-trotting unofficial emissary for all matters across the world.
Josh, real quickly, is there an element or a story here about cronyism?
I don't think so. I mean, he's somebody who he runs a think tank. Unlike his brother Tony Podesta, he's not in the lobbying business. So
you're all cronies down there in Washington D.C.
He gets a lot of fundraisers. Notice with a trip like this.
Josh Gerstein, White House reporter for Politico, joining us from Washington to talk about John Podesta, who was with Bill Clinton in North Korea. Thanks, Josh.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'd like to help you in your struggle to be free. There must be 50 ways to leave your lover.
Yeah, it's Splitsville over there at American Idol. Paula Abdul is leaving American Idol. A hearty, warm, sincere goodbye to her coming up. But first, a look at some of the top stories this morning.
They're known as the Gang of Six, and the president is talking health care with them today. That's three Republicans and three Democrats on the Senate Finance Committee who are working on the Senate's version of the bill. The president says he wants health care reform passed by the end of the year. Meanwhile, the Senate has reportedly reached a deal on the Cash for Clunkers program, that wildly popular program. It is they have a vote scheduled for later today. If it passes, car buyers will have until Labor Day to get their share of the additional $2 billion.
Selling used cars down on Capitol Hill. The Senate votes today on the nomination of Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor. Her confirmation is expected to go through easily. A pregnant woman accused of drug trafficking in Laos will serve her sentence in Britain, where she's from. Her crime would usually be punishable by death, but Laos does not execute pregnant women. Laotian officials say she may have artificially inseminated herself because she became pregnant while in jail.
And finally, researchers at Cambridge University have observed a close relative of the crow, the rook, dropping stones into a container to raise the water level. The birds are trying to get at worms floating on the surface. It's eerily similar to one of Aesop's fables in which a crow did the same thing. No morals to go along with this study, though.
Well, any chess player knows that rooks have very special powers.
They do, magical powers. So that's a look at some of the news stories we're covering for you today.
Oh, she loved TV, but how much did she love TV? She began as the show business professional whose discerning eye would separate the chumps from the contestants with real talent on American Idol, but she very quickly became American wacko.
I think what Paula was trying to say was...
I don't know what I'm trying to say.
I do, actually.
No, you don't.
Well, what Paula was trying to say is, it's being reported in the entertainment press this morning, Paula Abdul will not be a part of the ninth season of that television behemoth, that U.S. cultural celebrity campfire and employment program for Ryan Seacrest, American Idol. So Paula is out. And again, her wackiness will certainly be missed. And joining us to talk about what this means for American Idol and for Paula Abdul, for that matter, is Brian Stelter, media reporter for The New York Times in Ocean City, Maryland. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning.
And Evan Gregory, a former American Idol contestant on season 2 and member of the Gregory Brothers. Good morning, Evan.
Good morning.
Evan, you actually had one-on-one experience with Paula Abdul. What expertise, what sense of kind of entertainment acumen is American Idol going to miss with her departure?
Well, she was subject to total adulation by all the contestants who themselves were avid fans of the show at the time. But I don't think anyone had any misconceptions about her being the real brains behind the judging team.
That's Cowell, right?
Of course, of course. He was both intimidating and entirely respected.
But, Brian, wasn't a big element of this show the chemistry between the hosts, kind of like the chemistry John and I have? Like, I'm his Paula Abdul, he's Simon Cowell over here.
No.
It absolutely was, and viewers either loved Paula or hated Paula for that reason, but obviously
adding a fourth host. Listeners, will you love me, please?
The problem with that comparison, Amy Holmes, is that you can actually complete sentences, okay, and you get things right. Listen to this.
And the two songs made me feel like you're not fighting hard enough to get into the top four. So, David Cook.
No, we should just on the first song, though. Just on the first one. Just on the first.
I thought you sang twice.
Wow.
Just see, once, but no, Paula.
Just the Paula.
You're seeing the future, baby. You're seeing the future.
You know what?
She's coming back. All right.
This actually, is hard.
Okay, Paula. Paula.
No, it's David.
Paula, who is your favorite?
John, that so Brian, just makes her relatable.
Well, no, but you have not done that on this program. Let's just say that for the record. Brian Stelter,
I can try.
I'm going to miss those kind of moments on American Idol. I'm going to miss that.
There's been problems like that off the set, too. There was one television interview where she was speaking nonsensically and slurring her words. She sometimes came to work with an injury and then couldn't explain what the injury was. But that's what made some fans love her more. I suppose some people are attracted to that kind of judge.
A couple of details on the sort of entertainment elements here. I mean, do you believe that she walked away from a $5 million contract? Apparently, Ryan Seacrest got $10 million when he re-upped, and, you know, Kyle is worth millions and millions and millions in his ownership of the Idol brand.
Yeah, well, I think she was serious about the money. I think she felt she was being treated unfairly. And once the press reports leaked out about how much money Ryan Seacrest was making and about how much the other judges were making, the writing might have been on the wall. I think the other element here is that Idol's been on for 8 years now, and she may not want to be second fiddle to Simon Cowell anymore.
And, you know, actually that's fairly common in the entertainment industry. If, you know, one of the actors is getting paid a lot less and feels that they are equally contributing to the show.
Yeah, well, I walk away from $5 million deals once, twice, three times a week, really. Evan Gregory, was there any hint in your experience that there was a drug problem or some sort of, you know, off-the-set kind of issue for Paula Abdul?
Absolutely not. Now, my appearance with the show was pretty early on in its trajectory. It was already quite popular, but the reports that we've heard are several years down the road, and I think it's certainly possible that after years in the spotlight, you know, something else could have happened in her personal life. But at the time of my experience with her, she was entirely lovely, very personable, and likable.
Yeah, let's get to that, because Paula Abdul is very admired by her, a lot of her fans, and for, you know, being warm and generous with the contestants. Was that your experience?
Yes, very much so. And she provided a very welcome counterpoint to Cowell's personality.
Tell us about that.
Well, quite frankly, he's the same person off camera as he was on camera, at least to the contestants. I'm sure he's different in his personal relationships, but he basically maintained the same relationships with contestants at all times so that he could kind of have that scowling, intimidating personality, and so that you wouldn't have any undue confidence in entering the audition room by knowing him as some other person.
So Scowl rhymes with cowl. I love that.
So did Paula really serve a purpose for you then in getting comfortable to be able to perform and perform well?
Yeah, in fact, during my time on the show, there was actually a 4 or 5 day process of auditioning before you saw the celebrity judges. I think that's slightly changed now, but there's something similar that happens. And so on the 4th or 5th day, when you're finally getting to see the celebrity judges, you're completely exhausted. You're attitude is that of some kind of beaten down soldier that's been held in detention for 4 or 5 days. He
and
hasn't seen the light of day.
And there's Paula, you know, ready to give you a hug. Of course you're going to fall in love with her.
A beaming smile, a welcoming face. Everyone was totally, totally at their knees just waiting for her to arrive.
Well, Brian Stelter, if the ninth season for American Idol is the jump the shark season, losing Paula Abdul means there are fewer options for actually jumping the shark. I mean, what can they do on Idol?
Well, I think they recognize they need to make tweaks. They need to, in some way, each season now refresh the format. I mean, this is a show that is getting a bit longer than the truth. It's still the most popular show in the country. It's going to remain that way for the foreseeable future. But it has been almost a decade, and I can understand someone like Paula Abdul deciding that she's better off on her own after almost a decade on this show.
Well, quickly on that, the future for Paula Abdul, a reality show of her own, American Loathing, America. I mean, what do you think?
She has tried some reality shows in the past. Of course, they were no Idol, but they were something. And look, there's always the possibility she'll come back to Idol.
Oh, of course. I mean, I loved it, though, reading the entertainment press. We wish her well, said the producers.
Right,
that's a euphemism in L.A. for I hope you die tomorrow, correct?
It's a euphemism in some quarters in New York also, but
that's
never
right.
Say never.
Never say never. And there are no bridges that can possibly be burned in the entertainment industry, right?
Or rebuilt with enough money.
According to Brian Stelter, media reporter for our partner, the New York Times, talking to us from Ocean City, Maryland, about Paula Abdul leaving American Idol in the ninth season. Also joining us, Evan Gregory, a former Idol contestant. Evan was on American Idol in season 2. Thanks for joining us, Evan.
Now, Paul, we have a listener who disagrees with you and is a fan, and she emails us to say, before she ever started her career as a pop singer, she was the go-to choreographer.
Who was? You?
Paula Abdul.
Paula Abdul. Oh.
I mean, I can dance, but I can't choreograph. Her pop career wasn't so much to my taste, but she had a Grammy and 6 number one singles in the late 80s and early 90s. So listeners, please tell us your take at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or email mytake@thetakeaway.org.
So famous for being famous in the 80s? I don't know.
Famous. It's something. Come on.
Famous for being huge in the 70s and 80s.
So if you missed anything, listeners are always here on The Takeaway. Take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or iTunes. And here's your takeaway.
Those numbers simply have to come down, or Barack Obama is in a lot of trouble, not just on restoring recovery, but getting things like his health care policy through. It's becoming increasingly apparent that he's been focusing on the wrong ball, dividing up the pie instead of worrying about the fact that the pie is disappearing completely.
Oh, my goodness. That's Peter Morici, business professor at the University of Maryland and Takeaway regular.
Yeah, but we made him famous. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Amy Holmes. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.